Somebody please take away his Diet Coke button just for the weekend.
I got to get one of those.
Just for the weekend. Somebody take it away from him so we can have a weekend.
Okay. Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin, because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense.
Save big money on your next project at Menards. Brighten up your garage or workspace with a 6,000 lumen, three-panel LED light from GT Light. It's seven times brighter than traditional incandescent light bulbs and features three adjustable panels, allowing you to shine light where you need it most. Stock GT Light LED utility bulbs are on sale. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey, friends, and welcome back to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Sadie, and I'm here with my friend Rachel. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
Okay, what are we going to talk about today? Of course, we're going to give you a little bit of an update on what's going on with the confirmation hearings, because there's some news on that. Literally everybody over the weekend was asking me Doge, USAID, which I would say is a new phrase for the American public, because I mean, I knew of their existence, but it is literally everywhere.
And yet everybody is an expert on it. Didn't you know that?
Everyone
now knows everything.
Well, let me tell you straight up, we are not. So we are literally going to tell you what we have researched, what I know, and we're going to also do a little bit of speculation. Mm-hmm. But then also at the same time, we are not giant government policy. It
no.
is the USAID. The more I look into it, it is one of those annoying like government entities that's like independent but not independent, but still
right. Which is like why it's very good yes. that everybody's looking at it and going what? And then kind of wondering how many of these are there.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, we'll see what Doge finds.
Yeah,
speaking of Doge, there's a little bit of drama around
Doge drama.
There's Doge drama. I like that. Doge drama. The Panama Canal. Marco Rubio's in touring Latin America, politicking, diplomating, and tariffs. Tariffs.
Tariffs is at the top. That's what everybody is asking me about. Can you talk about tariffs, please?
But we have a lot to talk about today. And specifically, a few things that like I see nobody talking about, because, of course, the media is not going to talk about the fact that they cannot keep up with this 78-year-old man's news cycle.
Yeah, they're struggling. I mean, we're all struggling, to be honest, to keep up. But they are really having a hard time.
Well, and it's just hilarious because it's like they can't keep up with the very news cycle that they're reporting on. And the Dems are so far behind that the moment that they start some kind of talking point or narrative in 24 hours or less, it's no longer, it's like
relevant.
Changed. And they're constantly they're having to like course correct, and they just cannot keep up. But before we get into today's episode, if you are a new listener, we are so glad to have you here. Make sure that you hit that follow button. And if you are listening to this podcast with advertisement, we suggest that you click the link in the show notes to our Substack. As a paid subscriber, you will get a feed for you ad-free in addition to all of our extra content that we either already have or are going to be developing in the future. So you're going to love us. Okay. So go do that. But let's talk about first the question that, honestly, I got questions on everything, but we're going to start with specifically tariffs, because it was the talking point that was dominating over the weekend and resolved itself the quickest.
Yeah. Like as soon as I got the flood of
questions
from people telling me why this is horrible or why it's really good, then everybody had to kind of course correct because everything changed rapidly.
Yeah. So as we were entering into the weekend, Trump had announced his intent to implement tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China. So for Mexico and Canada, it was going to be 25%. And then on China, it was 10%. Just to understand a really quick explanation of what a tariff is, it is a tax that the importer has to pay to bring products into the United States. So it's not necessarily the Canadian or Mexican company or farmer. It's whichever entity it is that is importing the product, they're the ones that have to pay the tax. The argument is
the consumer is going to have to pick up the tab, really.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to raise the prices of the goods.
So that is the general argument against tariffs and what a tariff is. Now, as we talk about this, I'm also going to provide some context as to why Trump is using these tariffs. Because, well, first of all, we kind of saw part of it over the weekend. Yeah. Because over the weekend, after everybody had reported that the skyrocketing increase that was being predicted in grocery prices, and also the Democrats and the media will always kind of get like some kind of a narrative.
Yeah, they'll rally around something similar for sure.
Yeah. And so because the Super Bowl is coming up, mm-hmm. the talking point was how your Corona and your guacamole was going to be more expensive because of these tariffs.
When I saw that guy standing up at the podium, he pulls out a can of Corona. And one avocado.
Let's just take Super Bowl Sunday, okay? It's going to affect beer, okay? Most of it, Corona here, comes from Mexico. It's going to affect your guac, because what is guacamole made of? Avocados, both from Mexico.
Which, by the way, can I just look? I don't know if I got some Mexican friends that are listening to us, but right now we're going to do a little avocado battle here, okay? Because objectively, the Caribbean avocado that you can find in Florida, for example, is better than the Haas Mexican avocado.
Okay, can I tell you something? When we lived in California, our first house, we moved in and realized, I think maybe it was because I didn't grow up eating a lot of guacamole avocados on anything, really. We moved into this house that had a fully mature, beautiful avocado tree. And it would drop just year-round avocados that were humongous and delicious, tasted like butter. They were so good. We had a dog who would just lay under it and eat the avocados all day. She got super fat. And then we moved out of that house and had to start buying avocados at the store. First of all, it was a ripoff. And second of all, like, they weren't as good. The imported ones from Mexico were not as good as the ones growing in my California backyard. Delicious.
Was the skin of your avocado in your backyard?
Very thin and smooth.
Very and smooth. That is correct. Correct.
Yes.
Because that is so good.
And
avocado.
Now, yeah, I buy these puny avocados. I bought some at Trader Joe's the other day, 4 for $6. And they're like the size of a nickel. And I am just bummed. This makes me sad. So anyways, let's move on. But yes, I agree with you. Caribbean avocados. That's it. We've settled.
That is the one I grew up on. They're ginormous. They're delicious. I'm sorry. They're superior. Yeah. But which could have been imported if we just change our avocado
buying practices.
I know. With lower tariffs. So anyways, that happened over the weekend. Now, in addition to the concern of Corona and avocados, you also had Canada, I guess, trying to puff up his chest, which is really funny to hear, you know.
And when you say him, you mean?
I mean, Papi Trudeau. Okay.
Yeah, that's the kind of sort of president.
So he did a little presser over the weekend where he was informing Canadians that maybe now this means that they're just going to have to buy more Canadian. They started taking American whiskey and bourbon off the shelves, just all kinds of stuff.
And now is also the time to choose Canada. There are many ways for you to do your part. It might mean checking the labels at the supermarket and picking Canadian-made products. It might mean opting for Canadian rye over Kentucky bourbon or foregoing Florida orange juice altogether. It might mean changing your summer vacation plans to stay here in Canada and explore the many national and provincial parks, historical sites, and tourist destinations our great country has to offer.
So everybody is posturing.
Posturing, definitely.
But then we woke up Monday morning. So do you understand how these tariffs were coming into place first? This was via an executive order. And a lot of times there's this debate about, can he do these tariffs? And yes, he can do these tariffs for specific purposes. Specifically, he can implement these tariffs unilaterally as the president because of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 that allows presidents to impose tariffs for national security.
Right.
Now, it's to his discretion, I guess, at this point of what's considered national security.
Mm-hmm.
But his primary focus and the reason that he was using them was about the border security.
Yeah. And the flood of fentanyl into the nation.
Correct. So he was citing, he's saying, look, I got to do this because they're not protecting their borders. Mm-hmm. And it's putting us at risk.
Yep.
With the fentanyl, with the cartels, I don't even know if he brought up like possible terrorism or anything like that, but I would include that personally if I was president.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why he's able to do it. And it's not like an act of Congress or anything like that. He has the right to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the weekend, the media, everybody is talking freaking about how out. Much, just totally freaking out. And I'm getting messages of everybody freaking out
because they're sending messages that it's like illegal what he's doing. And if they took 5 minutes and a Google search or log into their AI program that their media network that they work for pays for, they would find out that it says within the parameters of his power as president.
Well, and I get it. I was actually talking about this with my husband because I get a lot of messages, which is why we're doing what we're doing. We're here to explain to you that what you're hearing sometimes is incomplete or is just
incorrect,
blown up or completely false.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's really challenging sometimes, especially when you're engaging with friends or family, when they're talking to you and they're like, do you understand how horrible this is? Because they're getting... like they're getting from one point.
Mm-hmm.
If tariffs were to be implemented, there are negative effects and they are by design. Mm-hmm. But also what Trump has been attempting, and he has shown, and in fact, I think I've talked about this while we were back in campaign games and people were still talking about the beautiful word tariffs when he would say that, is that he uses it as a negotiating tactic. Okay.
Yeah.
So when we got back on Monday, after everybody's meltdown about how expensive their guacamole and their Corona is going to be, and the fact that Canada wasn't going to buy our whiskey anymore,
mm-hmm.
it turned out that, so Trump had a phone call with Sheinbaum, which is the president of Mexico, and they reached a negotiation
mm-hmm.
where Sheinbaum specifically, the biggest part of it being that they were going to send 10,000 National Guard mm-hmm. troops to their northern border to help out with what is going on at the border. Specifically, by the way, something that nobody is talking about or very few people are talking about are the recent interactions that Customs and Border Control has had with the cartel at our southern border.
Yeah, some showdowns, really.
Literal showdowns. Like, they're shooting at each other.
And why is that not top of mind for these journalists?
I'm like, why is he talking about it? There was a hiker that was recently shot. I think, I don't know if he just like wandered over too far or something like that, but he was on the U.S. territory, got, I guess, a little too close, was shot at by the cartel. They also exchanged gunfire between Border Patrol and cartel members. Like, talk about the Texas, like, it. I mean, that is so Texas, honestly.
Nothing is more Texas.
I know. Having Border Patrol and the cartel shooting at each other literally on the line.
No, but doesn't this just kind of reinforce his whole purpose for imposing these tariffs in the first place? It kind of tells the story itself. I understand that the media hates, by and large, the legacy media, mainstream media, whatever you want to call it. By and large, they detest Trump. They don't just dislike him and some of his policies. They cannot stand him. And they're looking at the next 4 years of their life and realizing that it's going to be miserable for them because he can't do anything right. Truly, I will come on this podcast and apologize if that happens in the next 4 years when he does some objectively good policymaking.
They're like, oh, wait a minute. If they can
actually acknowledge it, but I don't think that they will. And so it's going to be shaping a narrative for the next 4 years, kind of taking everything that could possibly be interpreted as good, and they're going to find some snag, and that's what they're going to pull at. That's just what it's going to be.
That's what has been happening. I mean, the entire time that he's been in politics, but especially since he has entered the presidency, Mexico has agreed to send these 10,000 troops to the border, right?
And what does Trump do?
And Trump goes and he says, okay, well, then we'll put a 30-day pause on these tariffs. Now, of course, he's saying 30-day pause on the tariffs because he doesn't want Mexico to go and be like, okay, well, I guess we're good.
He is negotiating. And he used other types of tariff scares to negotiate with other people. Take your prisoners back or else. This is what leaders do. They negotiate. It just, to the media, it feels they don't like it. They do not like it. They feel like it's unstable.
Well, and I get that because it does feel like chaotic.
I guess, but they all were doing this stuff just behind closed doors. And it took a lot longer beforehand, you know?
Well, yes. But also I feel like it feels more chaotic sometimes because it's not even just like the media is like telling you what's going on. But in addition to that, we have all of this talking point opinion freak out. And they actually look kind of ridiculous because what ends up happening is that you have everybody freaking out, creating like these narratives that are really over the top.
And within 12 hours, they're either debunked.
And then you kind of look stupid. It was like when Fetterman, I think, was on The View like a week ago or maybe before he was even inaugurated. And he's like, we can't just be like freaking about every single thing.
All the time. Exactly.
All the time. Like we really need to pick and choose because ultimately what's going to end up happening at some point,
you're going to need to freak out. There's going to be something we need to freak out about.
And they're not, nobody's going to be paying attention or people are so tired of you freaking out that they're just like, they just cut you off. And they're like, no.
Everybody is already feeling freak out fatigue. That's exactly what it is.
Absolutely. So that's how, by the time, I think it was like Monday morning, that was the news that Mexico's president and Trump had had that conversation and they had come to that agreement. And then we also knew that he had a call scheduled with Trudeau at 3 p.m.
Yep.
And then after he had his call with Trudeau at 3 p.m., turns out they also enter into an agreement.
And I love it how it's called an agreement when really it's Trump telling them, you will do this or I will do this. And people just don't want to say it because you know what? I think for these elite journalists, whatever you want to call them, pundits, talking heads, they major on how professional they feel to themselves. They take each other and themselves extremely seriously. And there is a Trump's brand is kind of outlandish and loud and brash and quick and
kind of
unprofessional in a way, or that's what it seems like to them. They don't like it. Everything has always been handled in such a way that makes them feel comfortable and you don't know what to expect.
Well, it takes the control out of their hands.
It does. And then you got him on Truth Social and everybody else on Twitter just has something to say about everything. And yet he somehow is getting all this stuff done and it's unsettling for them. I think so.
But what was interesting is that even though after now you had Mexico checked off, right? Then you have Canada agrees to implementing a $1.3 billion border plan, which includes helicopters, technology, personnel, a fentanyl czar, a joint strike force to combat organized crime at the border.
All over a phone call.
So that's what's so interesting is because after Canada, I think in this announcement about what Canada agreed to, the talking point began to be, Trump rolled over because Canada and Mexico agreed to things that they were already doing or had already agreed to before Trump was in office, right?
They'd agreed to it with Biden?
Well, that's the thing. It's, again, can we please provide the complete context?
Yeah, I feel like something's missing here. Tell me.
So first of all, yes, there was an announcement by Canada and Trudeau in December, which would have been after the election, before the inauguration, about the $1.3 billion border plan to deal and secure like their southern border, but also their other borders too, right?
Okay.
After Trump was elected, after Trump has already been talking about tariffs,
Right. So basically with Trump, because, I mean, let's be honest.
Biden. That would be my assumption. But in addition to that, mm-hmm. in their conversation these other things, like the border czar, the Joint Strike Force. There was another
intelligence directive.
Yeah, exactly. There was an intelligence directive that they're backing it with $200 million. So there were some extras going on. Right. I also am pretty sure that in the conversation, there was like some firm discussions about this is exactly what we need and I need your commitment. Now, also in regards to Mexico, there was an article that I started seeing go around about how in 2021, the AP had reported that Mexico had already sent these 10,000 National Guard troops, right?
Have they? Where are they then?
Well, this is the thing. It's incomplete. If you read the freaking article, okay, the article was specifically talking about in 2021, there was a big migrant caravan, essentially, or there was like a large gathering of migrants that were coming up through Guatemala, Honduras, into Mexico to get to the United States. And what was negotiated at the time was that the three of them together would, I think Honduras or Guatemala, I can't remember which one, sent like 15,000 of their police to help disperse this group. So it was to deal with this particular group because it was coming on the heels of the midterm elections. Uh-huh. And there was a concern about this giant group of people that were going to come over the border. Mm-hmm. But in exchange for Mexico to send these 10,000 troops in 2021 to Mexico's southern border to deal with a temporary issue at the mm-hmm. time.
No, not the same thing.
Not the same thing. No. Biden also was like, I'm going to give you more work visas. I'm going to loosen up some of these policies to allow in more immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So don't tell me that this is the same thing.
It's not, but they're looking, they're searching. Again, he can't do anything right. So that's going to be what we're going to have to deal with.
And I would say like the only other thing that Biden did do was in 2023, which was more recent, and that negotiated with Mexico for Mexico to contribute $1.5 billion over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
For smart border technology. And so they were touting how this is going to make the border more secure because they're going to have cameras and they're going to have extra programs in order to vet and track people mm-hmm. or what was going on. Well, it turned out that some of the projects like the customs automation project, which included some technology systems uh-huh. that aren't compatible with the United States.
So
it made it, I don't know, just maybe not as effective as they were touting it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And also a reminder, this is $1.5 billion over 2 years. This was in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And this was also in exchange to expand worker visas and refugee admissions.
Hmm.
So it's again, just I'll let more people in, which was kind of like the main complaint that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main complaints.
For some smart automation that we can't even use here because it's not compatible with our stuff.
Well, it's just not as effective.
Let's just be honest.
So once the talking point went from we're going to be poor because of tariffs, right? Mm-hmm. And that the economy is going to be worse. And then he uses it as a negotiating tool to get to further secure the border, which has been his focus since day one. I mean, hello, deportations all around.
Yep.
Okay. Then the talking point becomes, oh, but Biden had already done this. This was something that was already agreed upon under Biden.
I'd say it's safe for everybody when you read a headline in the next couple years, really from anybody, but especially if it's from a legacy media, newspaper, cable news, anything like this, just do a little digging on your own, especially if it seems particularly hostile to Donald Trump in general, because I think that's kind of going to be their brand. They're very, very hostile to him, to his administration, and to anything really that he's put out so far. And he has objectively, if you sat down with people and actually asked them if they like some of his EOs and some of the problems he's really targeting in this first 10 to 14 days, people think that they're objectively good things he's doing. But
it's what people voted for. The Democrats don't seem to understand.
The media is just having a temper tantrum. It's like it's a meltdown for sure.
Well, what we saw over the weekend is a perfect example of how he's trying to use these tariffs. And it's mm-hmm. primarily as a negotiation tool. Now, the other argument is that if you wanted to get into like economic theory, for example, which we're not going to go really deep into, but if I was going to give you like a really quick summary, it would be short-term pain for maximum gain is what he's hoping, because is that when you implement tariffs, the hope is because those prices start to increase, either companies will move into the United States to avoid the tariffs and American people will start to buy more locally in order to not pay the increase in prices. So there will be some adjustment, which is one of the benefits, by the way, of being the largest GDP, I think next to like China, but specifically among the three countries, we're talking about Mexico and Canada, we have the largest GDP. So if there was to be a trade war that were to extend for a certain period in time, in theory, and I'm saying this in theory because other factors can change this, but in theory, we would be able to sustain that more than the economies from Canada and Mexico. Specifically, for example, if you think about Mexico, in addition to the tariffs, you have all of these deportations happening, which is a lot of times these individuals earn here and send money into Mexico, which means that money, which Mexico has become dependent on, is already lessened because of the deportations on top of people not wanting to possibly purchase items because they're more expensive, or companies that have moved to Mexico, even U.S. companies that moved to Mexico for production.
I heard from people with that issue too.
Yeah, they might come into the United States. That is the theory. The same thing applies to Canada. Their economy is not as big as ours. Even though we consume, they import more to us than we export to them. The fact that we wouldn't purchase from them as much because of the price increase is much more
detrimental to them
than it is to us. So the point is that would prices increase? Yes. Would we have to go through a period of pain? Yes. And that is also something that Trump was very transparent about over the weekend. He said we might have to do this for a time. But then the idea is that companies would come in, stuff would be done locally, that would increase the job market, it would improve our economy. And it is clear, it's becoming more clear to me that Trump's strategy in regards to lowering prices or making the economy better here in the United States is to grow our way out of it and stop the inflation rate where everything stabilizes. So the idea is that we kind of stay basically where we are at in prices, but because there's more jobs, there's more money, there's more prosperity in the country, then those prices don't feel as negative as they did when we were under Biden. And I feel like that's the strategy that they're attempting, especially with the new Treasury Secretary that's been appointed. But it's not as simple and as everybody tries to make it out to be.
Yeah, and I think that we have to remember two things can be true at once. There can be something that has initial challenges and discomforts, and that ideas can still be a successful idea and a good idea and something we should pursue. I believe that people, when they look at something like an issue like tariffs or another issue we're dealing with at the present with deportations, if there is something negative attached to it, if there is something that feels uncomfortable, that can have negative consequences for certain people for a time or in general, people automatically want to jump to, then it's a bad idea. And that's not always the case. Just because something, at least not always, but just because something might be frustrating or have a, like you said, a period of time where we're going to have to work through some discomfort. Things are going to be a little bit different than they are for a period of time. We're going to go through a stagnant period maybe, or a period of even decline to achieve a certain goal. That doesn't mean that pursuing that goal is wrong.
We also have to understand that Trump is doing this as aggressively as he's doing this because he needs really quick results as soon as possible before we get to the midterms.
Well, and I feel like he's flooding the zone, quite honestly.
Came in,
we are doing everything right now because he is a showman. Obviously, he wants massive impact right up front. But I think he knows he has to keep everybody on their toes. And he is confusing the heck out of the media. I mean, we do this and we love it, but I was used to having weekends off. We could literally know that Joe Biden was going to go on
do nothing
on Friday at noon, and you and I were going to have to check the news if we didn't want to until Monday. And now,
not anymore.
I'm waking up with like texts from people like, "Did you see that? It's a Saturday afternoon."
I was like, "It's Sunday. I'm trying. I need to go to church. I'm trying to bake off the sourdough."
And I think that that's a strategy, and he knows that. He's flooding the zone. He is throwing everything at the wall. He's seeing what's sticking. He is seeing what world leaders are responding to and if they're responding positively or negatively. And he's seeing what the American people, he knows that his base right now is very energized and very happy with what he's pursuing. And he knows that Democrats and the media are frustrated and upset. And he is capitalizing on all of that.
Well, and he's going off of his past presidency and his past experience and the fact that he had these 4 years to kind of like take a break, because a lot of things that are not being reported is that he instituted very similar tariffs during his first presidency, specifically some tariffs that Biden held on to. Okay. And at the time that he did initially pass these tariffs in 2019 during his first term, and it did have an objectively like negative effect on farmers, and he realized that how that was a problem, he made carve outs for them. And it's even in this last time when these discussions were being had, Grassley pointed out how farmers were very dependent on a particular ingredient for fertilizer that comes out of Canada. He's like, okay, fine, if you want to do this, but we need to have this carve out because then
they're the lifeblood of our country.
Exactly.
And always forgotten.
Of course, it takes a certain amount of trust, which I get. I don't think anybody should just hand over willy-nilly, but we do have something to reflect back on. And a lot of these similar strategies were done very early on in Trump's term. And by the time we started, we were like less than halfway through it. And before COVID, things were pretty awesome. So not that anybody else in the media is going to remind you of that, but that's kind of what one thing that nobody is talking about that I just want to include here really quick is that in that same EO.
Yeah.
Was this thing called de minimis. It was basically a loophole. So this de minimis loophole, what it was, is that goods that came from abroad that were less than $800 were duty free and did not have to go under any kind of stringent inspections.
Interesting.
Now, why is this interesting? Think about China, Shein, Temu, China dropship. All this like fast fashion, frankly, I'm sorry, this is where my opinion is really going to show. Crap that comes from China that is just flooding our landfills, where people are just paying $5 for a shirt and then throwing it away instead of sending it back or filling donation bins. Who's probably using some form of slave labor in China.
Oh, yeah. I have seen the footage of what those factories look like.
So now with this loophole, which nobody was talking about, was included in the EO and took effect on the 4th, which was yesterday. Okay. So now these items go under more inspection and there's going to be a tax on them, which is going to pass the consumer. That is a fact, but it's I can't even express, and this is a whole other episode, how problematic companies like Temu and Shein are, not only because of the reported abuses that are happening in China.
Just the sheer quantity of product that we are shipping into our country, and then we can't properly dispose of it. Where does it go?
And what it does to our own economy and our own businesses here locally.
Right, right.
And it conditions people to think that they can buy clothes for $5, $10.
Yeah, I go into a boutique and there's a beautiful sweater and I'm like, I'm not paying $88 for that. What a ripoff. And then I realize, oh, well, I'll probably own it for 25 years. And that, like you said, the fast fashion from Shein, you buy a pair of leggings and it has a hole in it day one. So we should do let's do a podcast on that. Let's do an episode on that.
I don't know. It'll be, I have a lot of beef and a lot of, I'm just.
But this is objectively good and you will not hear about it.
Now, obviously, granted, there are local, like there are Americans who run drop shipment businesses and this will have potentially an impact on them. So not everything is positive, but I just find it really interesting that this is something that has passed.
Yeah.
We're talking about, this is Temu, Shein, drop shipping, stuff like that. We're talking about millions of dollars here.
Yes.
Like hundreds of millions of dollars that are affected likely because of this, but it's not really anything that's being reported on much in the media. And we'll see how that changes the behavior of American consumers. Mm-hmm. So that's all the drama regarding tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
And I know everybody was asking about it, but then again, at the same time, like, we're recording this podcast and it's kind of like almost a moot point. You know what I mean?
No, but it's really not, because I don't think that everybody wants to dive deep into what a tariff is, what's its impact on both countries involved. And I think we offered a little bit of a primer, and now people can feel like, oh, all right, I kind of get what happened there, and maybe be able to talk about it.
Well, and I think it's important too that, you know, it's kind of like analyzing and dissecting Trump's behaviors and brain. Yeah. It's like trying to understand where is this coming from, especially because he's such a non-traditional politician.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think it's important to major on the things you want to major on, because tariffs are kind of, it's not the most fun topic to talk about.
No, it's to talk about their freak out.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things going on right now in the world. And so if we can help you by explaining tariffs, just a bit like you're a kindergartner, because that's what we are when we're learning about tariffs, then I hope it's helpful, because there's a whole lot of other stuff that's coming out of this administration that people are going to have to keep up on.
Yeah. The latest that also happened over the weekend was kind of like I don't even know how to talk about this, because it was like so much drama. It was Doge versus bureaucracy. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the meltdown that has happened because of Doge and their challenging of the bureaucratic state.
Well, Doge was already creating a meltdown just by itself. But then when it dipped its toes into, are we calling it USAID or USAID? I always have just called it
USAID. It's USAID.
But now that it's taking the freak out, the Democratic meltdown, to other levels. So I think that it actually is getting more attention than the tariff situation, if I'm honest.
Well, first of all, it's a much more complex situation. So because I was having a conversation with someone on my DMs, and for a long time, I had understood Doge, or the strategy with Doge was that it was essentially going to be an advisory board, like the Grace Commission, like Reagan did.
Yeah.
And it is, except it is in a way, but then also it's very different because of the implementation of it. Mm-hmm. And honestly, we just have a very different president. There's a lot of comparisons of Trump and Reagan, but Reagan was an actor. Trump is a literal hostile takeover businessman.
Yeah.
And right now, what I am seeing Trump do over the last, what are we, like 2 weeks into his presidency?
I mean, yeah, 2 weeks, 14 days.
I feel like it's been a year.
It's been a year.
Okay. Yep. So I would analyze, or if I were to provide an analogy, he is doing, like, in the most businessman Trumpian way, a hostile takeover of the bureaucratic state on behalf of the American people. Mm-hmm. Which is why he was elected. And one of those tools is Doge, who happens to also be led by
one of the richest men in the world.
One of the richest men in the world. One of the most brilliant businessmen in the world, even though possibly a little autistic. But I think that is actually a benefit to us, because he becomes almost obsessed about a certain goal, which is why he's able to accomplish what he's doing. And right now, that focus is Doge. Mm-hmm. So to give an explanation again, or a recap on what Doge is, it's a Department of Government Efficiency, but it's not a department. Okay. It is essentially Musk with 7 college students. Okay. In the most simplest terms, and that are like sleeping in government offices right now, digesting everything. Like, literally, they are sleeping in government offices. Some company sent them like sleep pods so they can sleep more comfortably in these offices. So they are working around the clock trying to dissect the bureaucratic state. Their focus currently is USAID.
First of all, before we dive in, how have there not been any pictures released on Twitter of them sleeping in said government offices? Like, how? I have not seen them.
Well, I saw a picture the other day of the, like, individual's face being blacked out, but the sleep pods arriving and going up in the elevator. Okay.
Wow.
So it turns out that they're not necessarily an advisory board. So what has happened is that Trump has repurposed the U.S. Digital Service under his executive office, right?
Right.
And then, which allows some of these employees to become federal employees, but not Musk himself, but the people that are assisting him are federal employees essentially under this digital service. Okay.
Yes, because you're going to hear that what Trump is doing with Doge and USAID is illegal. You're going to hear a lot of that, that it's not constitutional. He doesn't have this power. But in fact, if we want to get down to brass tacks, he does under the U.S. Digital Service.
Yeah. Also, yeah. In addition, just for historical context, Reagan had a commission called the Grace Commission that was used.
Had similar intentions.
Exactly. Now, both of them, by the way, which is also something that is not necessarily being covered, is required the, there were advisory and it required either the approval of the president, if it was like within his power as the chief executive, or Congress. Okay. Mm-hmm. The same thing applies to Elon and his muskrats, is what people are calling them. The people who don't like them are diving in and they're finding information and then they're giving their advice on what needs to be done. Now, Democrats are presenting this as overreach. Elon is talking about, look, I'm just looking for cutting wasteful grants, canceling billions in DEI contracts. Like, I'm trying to save you money, but I need access to this information in order to know, like, I can't tell you when needs to be cut if I don't know where, how things are being spent.
Right. He also needs transparency of where the dollars are going.
This is something to consider, is that because a lot of people are like, oh, he has access to sensitive information. Well, he's doing this under the executive branch. And there could be an argument that could be made, because I guarantee you that this is going to be challenged in the courts, probably. Mm-hmm. But there could be an argument that can be made that because it's under the executive branch and the president has a right to declassify things, like that Musk can have access to this. And by the way, Musk does have security clearances just because of the fact that he has government contracts for SpaceX.
He is very embedded in this. It's deeper than just he's looking over and reviewing some wasteful spending. There's a lot of layers here.
Well, and what I am assuming is that he's using all of these, because they're literally, like when I'm saying like these are college students, I think like the oldest one is maybe 22 years old or something like that.
They're just like big brained college students bringing in. He specifically targeted them for their
I'm sure their ability for tech and for coding and for running
quickly being able to ascertain where the dollars are being funneled.
Because I guarantee you they're accessing these systems and they're using, I don't know, computer stuff. Because I have no idea. Okay. They're using supercomputer powers or whatever, coding powers to analyze what is going on in there. And the only reason I even know who these guys are and their ages and stuff is because Wired Magazine did a piece on them and basically doxed these guys. And now they're being threatened.
I was going to say, I bet you they're getting death threats.
Yes, they're getting all kinds of threats now.
Activist kooks are coming after them.
Which then led the DC U.S. attorney ended up sending a letter to Musk. And in the letter, he says, we will pursue any and all legal actions against anyone who impedes your work and threatens your people. Because they were getting death threats and because they were trying to physically block them from accessing the offices. Because that was the other thing. Like, it was a whole showdown over the weekend.
Between the cartels and the Border Patrol, there's showdowns in Washington, D.C. It's a lot happening.
Well, while they're trying to get into the USAID, two security officials were eventually placed on leave because they had refused Musk and his team entry. Right?
Under what did they say? Just like, I don't like you. I'm not letting you in.
That they didn't have authority, that the information is classified, because here's the issue. Okay. So let me give you a little bit of background on what USAID is. So USAID, from what I have researched, because I have heard about them before, but I'm learning about them to this degree as much as everybody else is, because literally nobody knew what they did or that they existed.
Like 10 minutes ago. Yeah.
So during Kennedy, he signed an executive order that created the USAID. And the goal of it was to basically provide goodwill to foreign countries. Now, my guess is that his idea was that you create good relations with foreign countries. They begin to like the United States. And then it's beneficial for us for security purposes, diplomatic reasons, and that sort of thing. And because of that, it was created under the State Department. Well, then later, I think it was in the 90s under Clinton, it was codified. So it could not be revoked. You know, an executive order, if a president comes in and says no more, then you can revoke it.
Was it moved from the State Department at that time?
No. So that's
so it's
the
always
thing.
Been under a State Department. It's a leg of the State Department.
So this is where it's annoying. Okay.
This is what I need to understand. I need to understand who is over it.
So they're like kind of independent, but they're only independent in that they have to comply with the foreign policy goals of the United States as kind of dictated to them by the State Department.
I'm obviously, like, who's making these goals? Okay. So they have to follow dictates from the State Department, but they kind of operate.
Okay. So this is the way I would give you the analogy. Okay. Think about the United, like states, right? Mm-hmm. So states by themselves, we're all like independent. We can all kind of do our own thing. Right. Yeah. Except we can't go against, obviously, federal law and the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah.
So it's something similar like that, where the USAID is independent. Mm-hmm. However, they need to be in step with the foreign policy of the United States.
I want to know is who decides how they spend their money.
Well, they do. Mm-hmm. But again, they can't go against the foreign policy of the State Department. So what ends up happening is that the federal government, through their legislative process, they assign the USAID some funds or whatever. And typically what ends up happening is that they're going to be like, oh, for, I don't know, to go hug kittens. Okay. I'm just using an analogy here. Mm-hmm. And so then the department itself, the USAID, decides which kittens you get to hug.
Yeah. There's a lot of wiggle room right there, though. I can see a lot of fertile ground for corruption.
Exactly. So then now what is turning out is that with DOGE coming in and starting to do analogy for a long time before DOGE, there's been a lot of complaints about how the USAID has been basically running itself as a national independent like charity, and that they implement these programs abroad that go against the State Department foreign policy goals. And then when the State Department tries to call them out, they're not cooperative. So from some examples that have been recently revealed is $520 million spent on ESG consultants, $1.2 billion to undisclosed recipients, $375 million in DEI grants.
I'm beginning to see a pattern.
$2.5 million to DEI in Serbia. There was something about 47,000 on transgender operas in Colombia.
I'm seeing here 32,000 on a trans comic book in Peru.
In Peru. So they're...
Yeah, tear it down. Let's go.
Now, the Democrats are going to be like, oh, but what about AIDS and malaria and hunger? Well, that was the
fine.
Purpose.
Let's talk about that. That's fine. We can talk about that, but not a trans comic book in Peru.
Exactly. Now, a lot of people are like, well, can't we just get rid of it? You can't just get rid of it because it was eventually codified.
Well, okay? And Marco Rubio clarified that yesterday, I think, when he said, no, we're not shutting it down. We're just making some adjustments. Right?
Exactly. So what ended up happening is the tariff situation is kind of going on and is getting resolved. So then you have the Democrats decide to go and do a protest in front of the USAID offices, right? And during this protest, one of my favorites was Jamie Raskin. He started doing his whole thing. I think Ilhan Omar also spoke. Multiple Democratic leadership or identifiable individuals spoke. Yeah. Talking points were, this is an attack on our democracy. This is a constitutional crisis.
Elon Musk, you didn't create U.S. aid. The United States Congress did for the American people. Right. And just like Elon Musk did not create U.S. aid, he doesn't have the power to destroy it. And who's going to stop him? We are. We're going to stop him.
So we will use every power that we have in our disposal in the United States Senate. My colleagues will do the same thing in the House. This is a constitutional crisis that we are in today. Let's call it what it is. The people get to decide how we defend the United States of America. The people get to decide how their taxpayer money is spent. Elon Musk does not get to decide.
It's really, really a sad day in America. We are witnessing a constitutional crisis. We talked about Trump wanting to be a dictator on day one, and here we are. This is what the beginning of dictatorship looks like. When you gut the Constitution and you install yourself as the sole power, that is how dictators are made. What Trump and Elon and all of their cronies are trying to do is take away the constitutional power of Congress. We get to decide. We have the power of the purse.
And the constitutional crisis that they're trying to allege is that because Doge is walking in there and just the image they're trying to create is just marking things off and eliminating things.
Doing the melee, ripping off.
Exactly. Goes against the process of the fact that Congress has control of the purse. Mm-hmm. Now, again, Congress goes and tells USAID, go hug kittens. And USAID comes in and says, but we'll say which kittens you can hug. Mm-hmm. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they're not working. So then while Raskin is freaking out and they're all talking about how it's a constitutional crisis, that they're going to get rid of USAID and that AIDS, malaria, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Rubio, your best friend slash boyfriend.
He's doing great, by the way.
He's doing fabulously, by the way.
He really is. He is the best. I knew it all along. Thank you very much. I'll accept everybody.
Starting to change my mind here a little bit. Anyways, so he is in, I think at the time in El Salvador at this point. And he's asked about this, and he's basically, in the calmest way possible, explains why he has a problem, or there has been a problem with USAID, and why they're being moved under the State Department, and that it's not being eliminated.
Look, I mean, my frustration with USAID goes back to my time in Congress. It's a completely unresponsive agency. It's supposed to respond to policy directives of the State Department, and it refuses to do so. So the functions of USAID, there are a lot of functions of USAID that are going to continue, that are going to be part of American foreign policy, but it has to be aligned with American foreign policy. I said very clearly during my confirmation hearing that every dollar we spend and every program we fund, that will be aligned with the national interest of the United States. And USAID has a history of sort of ignoring that and deciding that they're somehow a global charity separate from the national interest. These are taxpayer dollars. And so I'm very troubled by these reports that they've been unwilling to cooperate with people who are asking simple questions about what does this program do, who gets the money, who are our contractors, who's funded, and that sort of level of insubordination makes it impossible to conduct the sort of mature and serious review that I think foreign aid writ large should have. We're spending taxpayer money here. These are not donor dollars. These are taxpayer dollars, and we owe the American people the assurances that every dollar we are spending abroad is being spent on something that furthers our national interest. And so far, a lot of the people that work at USAID have just simply refused to cooperate.
Are you currently in charge of USAID?
I'm the acting director of USAID. I've delegated that authority to someone, but I stay in touch with him. And again, our goal was to go in and align our foreign aid to the national interest. But if you go to mission after mission and embassy after embassy around the world, you will often find that in many cases, USAID is involved in programs that run counter to what we're trying to do in our national strategy with that country or with that region. That cannot continue. USAID is not an independent non-governmental entity. It is an entity that spends taxpayer dollars, and it needs to spend it, as the statute says, in alignment with the policy directives that they get from the Secretary of State, the National Security Council, and the President. And it's been 20 or 30 years where people have tried to reform it, and it refuses to reform. It refuses to cooperate. When we were in Congress, we couldn't even get answers to basic questions about programs. That will not continue.
It's really interesting, too, because for a while, a long while, Republicans, the GOP, Trump, the MAGA movement has all been kind of categorized as a little out there, kind of crazy, a little off their rocker. They're not as calm and professional and collected as Democrats. And what we're watching right now is a total role reversal. Democrats right now almost seem, the elected officials themselves seem unhinged, seem outside of themselves, and so worried that they kind of ramp up to this the sky is falling narrative for everything. And then you just kind of pan in and Trump's sitting at his desk. He's like, no, we're just going to negotiate. And he's answering questions. Pan over to Marco Rubio. He's like, I'm over here just getting things done, speaking in Spanish fluently, making deals, talking with people, normal foreign relations stuff. And it feels like everything's kind of flipped on its head. The adults are actually in the room and the kids are kind of throwing a fit outside.
Well, and I actually shared the contrast in my stories because they happened in a very short amount of time, one behind the other. You had Raskin doing this protest and the kind of the same talking points that they have been
over
doing
and over and over,
over and over,
yeah,
freaking out. And then Rubio's just like, look, USAID is supposed to be under the State Department. They're supposed to work with the State Department. They're doing interests against the State Department. Mm-hmm. So now I am the acting director and I have delegated this to someone who is very familiar with the process. Like, he's just kind of like calm and collected. Shortly after that, I see Trump is in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. Signing executive orders while asking questions of the media. Mm-hmm. And they ask him again about Doge and this USAID situation. And he points out, he's like, look, he does really hard work. But essentially, the summary was, he's not going to do anything without my approval. Mm-hmm. Some of the things I like, some of the things we don't like, some of the things I have to go to Congress, but he can't do anything.
Yeah.
Unless we agree to it.
President, why is it important for Elon Musk to have access to the payment systems at Treasury?
Well, he's got access only to letting people go that he thinks are no good if we agree with him. And it's only if we agree with him. He's a very talented guy from the standpoint of management and costs. And we put him in charge of seeing what he can do with certain groups and certain numbers. The numbers, some of the numbers are horrible, what he's found. 100 million dollars on condoms to Hamas, and many other things that are frankly even more ridiculous. And they're finding tremendous waste, more than anything else, I think you could say. Probably fraud and abuse could be added to it, the more standard waste, fraud and abuse. But they're finding tremendous amounts of really bad things, bad spending. You've been writing about some of it, frankly, and some of the things that they've been doing is just terrible. Elon can't do and won't do anything without our approval, and we'll give him the approval where appropriate. Where not appropriate, we won't. But he reports in, and he... It's something that he feels very strongly about, and I'm impressed because he's running, obviously, a big company. It has nothing to do if there's a conflict that we won't let him get near it. But he does have a good natural instinct. He's got a team of very talented people. We're trying to shrink government, and he can probably shrink it as well as anybody else, if not better. Where we think there's a conflict or there's a problem, we won't let him go near it. But he has some very good ideas, and we have a lot of very other talented people also. We're bringing in the most talented people.
Just cool, calm, and collected.
Which is, so everybody,
calm down. And it's really funny to watch him trying to save Americans' money, trying to make the country safer through deporting actual violent criminals, negotiating with other countries. It doesn't seem very dictatory, and that's what we've been told, is this violent fascist dictator is going to get into the Oval Office and strip our country of its democracy. And it just doesn't feel like that. And they have nowhere to go with that narrative. So they're just going to keep banging that drum.
Well, and then the other thing that kind of also happened over the weekend that was like a little bit of a side story was that Doge gained access to the like payment processing center of the Treasury Department. Mm-hmm. And they're like, the headlines are like, gain access to sensitive information and the social security numbers of American citizens. And you'll see talking points of like, they have hard drives, they could be saving it to benefit themselves. And look, I get it. Yes, obviously, if you give anybody access to anything, there is the potential that they will abuse it to their own benefit. For example, like the federal bureaucrats that just cut checks to whatever program they feel most benefits them politically or puts money in their back pocket.
Or an NGO that everybody is told you need to trust them because they're doing good work and they're funneling money to terrorists. So let's just...
Or facilitating illegal immigration.
Let's
which
not
facilitates...
act like this is the first time that potential fraud could be happening. And that this is the first administration to have potential corruption.
Like, well, and then specifically in regards to the Treasury Department, the depiction was like they forced themselves in there, right?
Yeah.
Well, it turned out that they were granted permission by the head of the department, which was the newly sworn in Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. So eventually there was this guy, I think his position was like Fiscal Assistant Secretary of the Treasury or something like that. David Labrick. I'm probably mispronouncing that last name, but he was put on administrative leave because he was not willing to cooperate and give Elon and his muskrats access.
Musketeers.
I like that. Access to the systems, which are systems that approve payments to everything. And I don't know how, like, this hasn't been verified, but Musk claimed that this system, that the Treasury Department hadn't denied payment to anyone or anything in years,
really?
And that they haven't undergone any kind of significant audit. So they could be cutting checks
to whoever knows who
in fraudulent programs. I don't know. The problem is that there's a lot of transparency happening here.
Transparency is hard for people who haven't had any transparency for many, many years. And so that can feel unsettling. I keep going back to that word, but I feel like everybody's just... kind of on edge.
Well, and again, it's just like the same talking point of constitutional crisis, a threat to our democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same thing that happened over the weekend to, or like right before the weekend with Pegasus put out a memo about how the Pentagon press offices did some changes to the Pentagon press offices.
I just learned when he sent out that memo that organizations like NPR, MSNBC, whatever, they have press offices at the Pentagon. And why? I want to understand that. Why are there press offices there at all?
I don't understand, like, why these particular publications would have almost, I don't know if it's 24/7 access. Yeah, it just feels like special access.
But like, why does any press
organization
have access? I feel like maybe there should be no offices there for the press at the Pentagon.
Yeah. Well, I think, and, yeah, I mean, they don't have them at the White House.
That's
they do have the White House press pool. So I guess that's not correct. So,
but it's not an office where people are just working every day with Pentagon officials. That's just weird to me.
I don't know. But what was there was that they had permanent office. So the New York Times, NBC, NPR, and Politico.
Huh. All very similar there.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was NBC not only had offices, but they had the full-blown like media, like a studio or something like there, like a little mini like satellite studio there.
This is very weird.
Pegasus put out a memo that basically booting them out and then replacing them. And this is with One America News, Breitbart, The New York Post, and Huffington Post.
That's a bizarre combination.
Well, and it's a very, obviously, very drastic change.
They're not happy about that.
I will point out that who was there before, New York Times, NBC, Politico, NPR, all liberal left-leaning platforms. This little group is a little bit more smidgen diverse, obviously.
Oh,
One
yeah.
American News and
Huffington
Breitbart.
Post and Breitbart, they're not like simpatico.
No.
But they also, this okay, I love Breitbart. I loved Andrew Breitbart, but it's not the publication it once was. These four seem a little bit more like tabloid-esque to me, just a little bit. Am I wrong there?
I mean, I don't know.
I mean,
so I will say kind of they're definitely not what I would categorize as like the top tier publications.
Uh-huh.
But what I will point out is Huffington Post is a left-leaning publication.
Correct.
Okay. Huffington Post is no fan of the Trump administration or the DOD in general. Okay.
Right.
So I think it kind of says a little bit of something that they've let the Huffington Post in. Now they're obviously balancing that out with
OAN.
Yeah.
Where's the Rivera and Reeves office? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm still waiting for our press credentials over at the White House. But I will have you know, even though you're denigrating the New York Post there.
I am not denigrating it. I am not at all. I have friends that publish in it.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I will have you know that the New York Post is one of the oldest publications in the United States, founded by one of our founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, in 1801. It initially started as the New York Evening Post and then became the New York Post.
I like okay? it. I'm not denigrating it. I just simply, when I hear OAN, Breitbart, New York Post, Huffington Post, just felt a little bit less serious.
But also the New York Post has broken some major stories. Okay.
For sure. They have. And if I'm honest, I would trust the New York Post over NPR or Politico.
Good job.
Or the New York Times or NBC. So New York Post wins. Alexander Hamilton would be proud.
Well, the talking point was that this is propaganda. This is dangerous.
Why is it dangerous? They need to get new vocabulary.
I don't know. First of all, something that nobody mentions about that memo. Mm-hmm. is how all of these news organizations still have their press passes, including every other news organization.
They just don't have a comfy couch and a bunch of desks and their mini fridge there.
Mini fridge. Correct. And by the way, it was the Biden administration, like, let's change offices here. When we're talking about the White House, the Biden administration revoked a ton of press passes.
What'd they say, 400 and
yes, something. It was something ridiculous. Okay. And the new White House has now reinstituted all of those press passes and expand access of the White House press pool to independent podcasts, journalists, social media, all kinds.
Okay, so how quickly did you apply for your press pass?
I think I was literally watching it.
I went to my computer, click, 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 click. My daughter ran and she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, the usual, just applying for a White House press pass.
I'm like, and we'll see.
I have a bunch of friends that did too. I was talking with a couple of them. I'm like, hey, if you get accepted and I don't, I'm okay with it. I'll be jealous for a few minutes, but then you have to come out, stay on the farm and
the deets.
Yeah, give me all the details. Get me some White House swag if you get to go and I don't.
Well, again, I just don't feel like this talking point. I mean, this is literally one of the most transparent administrations that we have seen in the last 2 weeks in all of the 4 years of Biden.
Right. And Democrats don't have to like what is they're being transparent about, but you have to admit they are talking to the American people 1,000% more than the past administration. It's very pro-transparency, which I think is a good thing objectively for the American people.
I think they just they're a little overwhelmed that they no longer have their 4 year long vacation from because of
I kind of miss my weekends. I'm missing my Saturdays and Sundays.
I know. By the way, can we just do a really quick side note and acknowledgement of your boyfriend, Rubio?
I would love that. I'd love nothing more. So, he's getting his due finally. I knew it in 2016. Here we are 9 years later.
There was all this talk about the Panama Canal and all the concerns, because if you don't really know, there was rising concerns about Chinese influence at the Panama Canal because Panama had agreed to take in or to accept funds of the Belt and Roads Initiative out of China. And so typically what this is that China says, we will give you this money so you can invest in your infrastructure. But typically that money has strings attached to it. Mm-hmm. And that is a major concern for the United States because that puts Chinese influence into those countries. Specifically around with Panama, some of this infrastructure that was being built and some of these offices were being built were like for the Chinese. Okay. Rubio goes down there speaking Espanol. Okay. Yes. Has a chat with the president of Panama and then announces that we're cool now with Panama. Panama has agreed to not renew their Belt and Road agreement with China, mm-hmm. to reevaluate China's port operations. And I think now also we have U.S. military ships have free passage through mm-hmm. the Panama Canal. So all of this talk about freaking out that the United States or Trump is going to lose his mind and invade Panama, and we could end up in a conflict with Panama over the canal. Over. Okay. Because Rubio goes down there and meets with Bukele, which is their president. First of all, we'll talk about what happened there. But I was watching, like, Bukele put out a bunch of video and a bunch of the U.S. Secretary of State is visiting. The amount of cultural cues that I saw happen between these two men that are clearly, especially being Puerto Rican, like, they're such obvious Latino social cultural cues of just how they greeted each other.
I think that's important. When I was initially really pleased with Rubio as the pick, it wasn't just because I like the guy and I think he's nice and he's been a good senator in Florida. It's because he can offer something that past secretaries of state can't. When you're able to speak the language and understand the culture with the people you're speaking with, you don't need an interpreter. You're able to have a level of familiarity. And like you said, you can pick up on social cues. You won't miss certain nuance in the language. I think that that's important, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I think it is absolutely a benefit for the United States. Not only is Rubio in of himself by alone, without him being Cuban and of Cuban heritage and being like completely competent and able and strong and clearly able to do this job, as we've seen demonstrated just in this short amount of time. But it has to be an absolute benefit that he speaks the language and understands the culture of an entire, like, the South. Now, obviously, we're not a monolith. We all have our different cultures and cues and stuff like that. But in general, a lot of the Latin community or a lot of the Latin, like, individuals have very similar cues that overlap in culture. The way we greet each other, the way that it's very warm. It's almost like when you initially meet someone, it almost comes off as casual to someone who's maybe unfamiliar because
he was able to understand that. And that
exactly.
is an absolute benefit to the department that he's the head of.
Yeah. And so I watched that I watched them interact, and the way he greeted him with a hug and then gave the wife like a kiss on the cheek, like, that is all very, very much within the culture. And so it was really cool to see. Yeah. And I think it really helps with our relations, especially when we're dealing with so many issues that come out of Latin America. But what did end up happening, and what I expect the next news cycle to be, is that Bukele agreed to, there's this concept of like safe third country. And so this is what happens when, for example, you need to deport someone.
Oh, are you going to bring country, up the prison?
Yeah,
the
I'm going to bring it up real quick.
Yep, because that's going to hit the news for sure.
So there is this idea of a safe third country where if someone isn't accepted by their country of origin, that then you can deport them to this other location or this other country to hold them until those things are worked out or until their country agrees to take them back. Specifically, for example, Venezuela. So we have a lot of issues with Venezuela and the gang members that are coming out of Venezuela into the United States. Venezuela may not want to take them back. For example, remember Colombia initially didn't want to take back their people. And so if that ends up happening, instead of us having to incur the cost of housing them and keeping them detained or in prison, Bukele has agreed to take them. Now, Bukele, his prisons are like these. I mean, if you go and you do a search, like, the images that come out of these prisons to U.S. citizens is probably shocking because of the mere size of them and how many people are in them. Now, Bukele says that the United States will pay for them to house them or to keep or imprison them. And the cost of that is significantly less than what it would cost us to do it here in the United States. So it's a benefit to us because we save money, but it's a benefit to El Salvador because they make money.
Okay. So before we talk about the legality of this, if this is even legal to do, what is the benefit, aside from the cost benefit, for them to take our prisoners?
Well, in addition, the other thing that Bukele announced that was agreed to, which oddly enough, I haven't seen a whole lot of reports about it here in the United States, is that the United States agreed to assist them in building up nuclear energy to help them gain energy independence.
Okay. So I was just wondering, it had to be more than just the cost incurred getting that an extra kickback or something. It have to be more than that to take dangerous criminals off our hands.
Now, the issue of having a non-US citizen being held in a third country when their country of origin won't accept them, if there is a treaty, it's not unheard of. In fact, we have that with Canada, by the way.
Interesting.
And Canada has it with us. Now, the issue is that in addition to that, he announced that they would be willing to take U.S. citizens.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the legality of that, too.
And I just feel like I don't think you can do that.
This is interesting.
Because the problem, I'm not going to say the problem. Well, it is. The issue is that U.S. citizens have a protection under the Constitution of the United States. They have a right to due process. Mm-hmm. And there are certain conditions in regards to how prisoners are kept and how they are dealt with.
Yeah.
That only the United States would have jurisdiction over and a right. say over
in
and
any
legal ramifications
that.
Over yeah. than if you go and you send them off to El Salvador.
Yeah, I feel like this might not work. I feel like this is not going to go the way he mentioned.
And I haven't looked into it sufficiently, but I guarantee you this is going to be the next news cycle.
Of course, and it's going to be a picture of the criminals in the prisons and how they have them. I mean, just like these massive, massive holding rooms where there's just hundreds and hundreds
well,
of prisoners.
Well, and what Bukele is using them for is for production. Mm-hmm. There's just rows and rows and rows of them. I mean, sure. He released images of, it almost looks like AI. I don't know. Yeah. It could be AI. But there was like rows of them, like using sewing machines, producing for like products for Venezuela to send out. I don't know.
Well, I have one more question. When you mentioned this needing this third country to house citizens that a country doesn't want back, how can, and I mean, maybe there's a simple answer to this, but isn't it as simple as I don't care if you don't want them back? They're your citizens. You need to take them. Like,
I mean, what are you going to airdrop them into the country?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It kind of feels like that's what deportation is and what Trump has been doing. And
well, I think the issue there is that at some point they have to be transported over there. Most of the time it's via a plane.
Yes.
And so if you're sending a plane into
an airport with a bunch of hardened criminals, you're just like, bye-bye.
They could end up surrounding the plane and then not letting them, you know what I mean? Like it creates like optically, I could see a lot of problems that it could create.
And like, so who are the countries that are just telling the US, like, we're not going to take,
I think primarily it's Venezuela.
It is just.
But I think it's also in anticipation of
being a problem elsewhere.
Yeah. Especially if the countries look, that guy is a horrible person and a really bad criminal.
Yeah. So why should we have to keep him?
You deal with him. You know what I mean? But also at the same time, I don't know what does that create for diplomatic relations, policy.
Tangled web for sure. That's okay because Marco Rubio, he's on it. Don't worry, guys.
So that is what has been happening for the last,
the weekend, just like 2 days. And we didn't even talk about everything.
There is so much. Like, let me tell you, the struggle that I'm having right now is just trying to prioritize what to talk about.
Yeah.
Because there are so many other things that we could also talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really, sometimes I'm thinking like, maybe we're just going to have to do some little side episodes that are exclusive for paid subscribers.
I think that's a good idea.
So I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up for today's pretty dense episode. And I feel like every other one is probably going to continue to be this way until this man takes a nap. Somebody please take away his Diet Coke button just for the weekend.
I got to get one of those.
Just for the weekend. Somebody take it away from him so we can have a weekend. All right, friends. Well, let's go ahead and wrap up this episode of Rivera and Rees. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. If you are a first-time listener, please stay with us. We would love for you to continue to hang out with us. In order to do that, we recommend that you hit that follow button, okay? And because we are now your new favorite podcast, you're going to give us a 5-star rating, leave us a lovely review, and it just warms our heart when everybody does that. So we really appreciate that. By the way, if you're tired of listening to those ads, click the link in the show notes and consider becoming a paid supporter where you will get ad-free episodes and all of our bonus content. And you also support this little ragtag team of trying to, you're going to get Mercedes off of the editing podcast hamster
that's
wheel.
That's the real goal. That's where any and all money that we funnel in will go to saving Mercedes' sanity.
That's goal number one. But thanks so much for hanging out with us. And make sure that you're following us on our socials because, as you know, there's going to be some news dropping today, obviously, on this whole Bukele thing, but also on the confirmation votes through committee for Tulsi.
RFK. In about 2 hours.
By the way, like, apparently the phone lines got so flooded, collapsed. Good on you. Congratulations. Yep. Golf clap. Okay.
Yep.
So that's it. That is all we have for today's episode. We will see you on Thursday for another episode of Rivera and Reeves. And a reminder that our employment is pretty solid because the media continues to be trash and we have no tolerance for it.
Bye.
Bye.